Okay. Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Wednesday, April 10th, 2013 will come to order. Senator Schmidt has two bills dealing with silica sand. Senator Schmidt, maybe what you should do in your presentation is just kind of describe the two bills, if you can, at the same time. Maybe outline the differences between the two. And then I see some of the testifiers are the same ones for both bills. And so if they would like to just testify one time instead of twice, so that we can do this. I don't know if I have anybody listed on this bill that on my sheet here that is opposed to this any of these bills or would like to give some kind of other type of testimony. But if there's anybody out there who's thinking about testifying in opposition to the bills or to give their opinions about the bills that aren't listed on this, can you raise your hand? Or okay. So we have some people that might be testifying in opposition. So what I think we'll do is we'll give you about 10 minutes. Is 10 minutes enough to describe the bills?
Mr. Chair, that would be fine.
And then I think what we'll do is we'll do about half an hour for the proponents and then half an hour for the opponents. Okay, and then my intent is to lay the bills over and figure out what to do next. Okay. So Senator Schmidt, go ahead and outline the bills and we'll go.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I appreciate the chance to be in front of you tonight. I know we had a bonding provision related to silica sand, I think, before this body last week, and there's a great deal of interest, so I felt obligated to come before you again here tonight and talk a little bit more about the matter. We have two bills here, Senate File 786, which has made its way through the committee process here in the Senate, and also Senate File 1018, which has made its way through the committee process in both the Senate and the House. And there's some similarities in both bills. There's some differences. And I'll just do a very brief overview of both bills, and for discussion purposes, be happy to discuss them together here tonight. And I guess before I say anything else, it's my understanding that we will be laying these over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill tonight, and we will have an opportunity hopefully down the road to hear these bills separately and maybe move them out independently. So I appreciate that. I guess in Senate File 786 here, Section 1, just quickly, we have a prohibition of mining silica sand on public lands or leasing public lands for mining silica sand. I'll just go over the applicable sections here. Sections 2 and 3 deal with definitions and applicabilities. Section 4 here on page 2.32, creates the Southeastern Minnesota Silica Sand Board, and this is an optional board, membership of which is open to counties and cities that currently have permits before them. Moving on here to... And the idea behind this board is to have a conversation towards the development of a model ordinance that may be adopted by the counties or the cities involved. This would be an optional membership, optional adoption of the model ordinance. Nothing in this this section would supersede local decision making. Moving on to page 5, we have section 5 on 4.25. I'm sorry, yeah, page 4. On Section 5, we have the technical advisory team, and the idea here is that this team would be formed by the Environmental Quality Board with representation from appropriate state agencies, whether it's Health, PCA, DNR, MnDOT, etc. And these technical experts would be available to provide advice and consent and expertise to local decision makers in terms of establishing ordinances at the local level and making permitting decisions. The idea is that we have a lot of expertise in state agency currently. Let's make sure that expertise is available to our local decision makers who want to utilize that in making decisions at the local level. Moving on to Section 6 here, we have the Model Ordinance Development and Adoption. And again, this body would move towards forming a model ordinance. But again, it would be at the discretion of the local decision makers whether or not they wanted to adopt that ordinance and the standards that derive from that process. Moving along here to Section 8 at the bottom of the same page, call for a generic environmental impact statement. that would study essentially three areas of question right now that the Environmental Quality Board in the past year have identified as is lacking in firm information. One would be the cumulative water impacts on large-scale silica sand mining or a lot of mining activity in a given region. So where are the impacts on water quality and quantity? Similarly, air quality standards and what is the impact of fugitive dust or of crystalline silica dust in an open environment? We know that in a closed environment, it can cause cancer, silicosis, but in an open environment where it's blowing around, we just don't know if this is a threat or not. This is a question that has been raised at the local level repeatedly, and I think it would serve our local decision makers well to have more clarity on that topic. And the third thing that we would like the generic environmental impact statement to address is the cumulative impact on transportation. With the mining activity we've seen in western Wisconsin, we've seen a lot of mines that will put the sand onto trucks and haul it on county roads to towns, to ports, to rail. And the question is, what is the impact, the cumulative impact of a large increase in truck traffic in our small communities and our rural roads? So we've scoped out the activity of this GEIS, and I think that would save us a lot of time in a potential study by scoping it out and asking the questions here and not in the process of the study itself. This in Subdivision 4, it should be pointed out that there is a one-year state moratorium on new mining activity that would be effective until March of 2014. And then moving along, we have Section 9 at the bottom of page 6, interim ordinance extension or renewal. This would give local units of government the authority to extend local moratoria an additional 2 years. Currently in law, they can have up to 2 years for local moratoria. Some of our local decision makers and local units are facing or are hitting the end of that second year already. The idea here is if we're going to spend some time studying this topic, we should give them authority at the local level to extend their moratoria in the meantime. We do have in Section 10 here on page 7, the EQB is given, new powers to overrule a local decision regarding an EAW or EIS determination. And that might be cause for some discussion later on. And then moving along here, we have an appropriation here. In Section 11 here, 7.15, the EQB is giving essentially emergency rulemaking authority over the summer here to establish some clarity on three things. One is categorical standards for EAW, EIS, and also to weigh in on what is meant by phased and connected activity. That's a question that's facing a lot of our local decision makers, and clarity on that matter would be helpful for them. And I guess we end this with an appropriation. So that's just a brief overview of Senate File 786. And fortunately, members, Senate File 1018 is a little bit shorter, so we can go through it very quickly here. We have similar definitions to start out the bill in Section 1. In Subdivision 2, what we're calling for is the EQB, in consultation with local units of government, to develop model standards and criteria for mining, for processing, for transporting silica sand. This, again, would be in consultation with local units of government, and the standards and criteria that are established would be at the liberty of the local units of government to impose. So that's what's called for here is using the EQB to help establish those standards. But at the end of the day, the local units of government would have the discretion as to whether or not to impose them. And we've spent a lot of time here, both in the House and the Senate, scoping out what sorts of questions and what sorts of standards need to be established here for our local decision makers to help them out. We also have the formation in Subdivision 3 on 3.13, the formation of a silica sand technical assistance team. This is very similar to what I described that was in Senate File 786, so I won't take time going over that here. I guess one thing that is applicable in both bills here, this technical advisory team is meant to be a resource for local decision makers, and the findings of the technical advisory team, would not be imposed upon the local decision makers, and it really is something that the local decision makers could tap or to go to approach and utilize that resource. And I guess, let's see here. In Section 2 on 4.1, we have the creation of a technical assistance ordinance and permit library, an online library where, best practices and model ordinances and current ordinances and standards could be shared from one local unit of government to the next. And then third here, in Section 3, we have, I guess, rulemaking. We're asking the commissioners of PCA, DNR, and Health to establish specific standards as it relates to, particulate emissions and land reclamation, and finally, health advisory for air quality. So those are three specific, rules that we'd like established in those respective departments. And, of course, we end with an appropriation. So, members, that's a very brief overview. I think some of you have had an opportunity to hear these bills before. Hopefully we have an opportunity later tonight to take questions. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you have any initial questions, I'd be happy to stand for those. Otherwise, I know we do have some additional testimony.
Mr. Mueller, maybe can you tell us a little bit about the fiscal notes or fiscal note? Or?
Mr. Chairman and members, there's a completed fiscal note on Senate File 1018. Right now, the one for 786 is still preliminary. But I'll speak to some of the general things on 786. On 1018, it notes, I think, I'm not going to go over everything. I'll just note some of the highlights. You'll see the costs. It assumes here of about $1 million in fiscal year 14. Depending on how the effective dates work, there would be some costs in fiscal year 13, a small amount. And you'll notice the FTEs on the first page, too. It assumes about almost 9 FTEs needed for mostly the in PCA and DNR. Page 5 kind of spells out the detailed cost with the PCA and what they attributed to. The costs for the Environmental Quality Board are borne within the PCA. But you'll see where that box there on page 5 kind of shows where the new FTEs would be and what sections of the bill they relate to. So there's a total cost to the PCA, about $500,000 in fiscal year 14 and 15 each year. Then it goes down a little bit in the other years.
Okay.
Just quickly on 786, since there's just a preliminary note, the costs on that one, now some of the costs, depending on how we look at these bills together, I'm not saying they stack on top of each other because maybe there would be some redundancy in the two costs, but at least preliminary, it shows about $1 million cost for doing the generic environmental impact statement, and then there's another million or so for the task force in that bill. Advisory team. So that's just generally what it would be, and like I said, maybe by next week we'll have a completed fiscal note on 7086, or we can see how these two bills work together about whether there'd be some different costs or assumptions once worked together.
Okay, thank you. Any Senator Ingram?
Thank you,
any
Mr.
questions
Chair,
on the,
and
this one order of
I'm
the
sorry.
Author.
I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Go.
Okay.
I was just
thinking, real quickly. You have a local cost here. What do we have any idea what that's going to be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, we do not right now.
Okay. Are there any questions of the author before I bring up witnesses? Okay. Then. Keith Fossen, you're first on the list, and you're listed on both of them, so why don't you tell me what you think of both bills. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, real quickly, I know you're running these two bills together here.
I know this is not normal.
No, that's fine. I'm good with that. I'm just wondering if we can ask the author some questions after testimony then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Mr. Fossen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, distinguished members of the committee. My name
excuse
is Keith
me,
Fossen.
Mr. Fossen. That's encouraging, Senator Ingebrigtsen, because I figured you all might leave before we got to that point.
I would have got up.
That's good. Okay, Mr. Fossen, go ahead.
I'm glad I'm only going once. I'm a township supervisor in Hay Creek, Minnesota. That's just on the western border of Red Wing.
And, you know, I'm sorry for interrupting you again, but let me just say this. If you're listed on both bills, you don't necessarily have to testify on both bills. You can just tell me your opinion of this whole thing if you want to. I mean, that's kind of what we want to hear, okay?
Mr. Chair, that's what I'd hoped I could do.
Okay.
I'm articulate in a way, but I don't think I'm going to cover the world with words this evening. As a township supervisor, I have two main concerns. My number one concern is jobs. It's very important to me. I grew up in a small business. I've been a businessman all my life, so I've always took a hard look at the economics of jobs. Now, as a township supervisor, my second biggest concern is the welfare of the people of my small township of Hay Creek. I start with the jobs, and, you know, this is an emotional issue. I've been looking at this for 2 years, and I hear a lot of talk and a lot of emotion and a lot of hyperbole. That's a big word for a guy from Hay Creek, but it's...
We don't have that word on the range.
Good. Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I grew up in Hovland, Minnesota, just north of Grand Marais.
And
many of my relatives actually worked in the Iron Range, especially during the taconite time, so I got a chance to experience that area very well. But even more so, what applies to my area is the trout streams of the northeast and the trout streams of the southeast. And how do we protect those? So as a township supervisor, I'm sitting here trying to figure out how do I balance those things. So I tried to get to some facts, and I did some research and study, and my wife is a PhD, which really helped me because she's a lot smarter than me. And I got to some facts. I looked in 2010 in Minnesota Revenue Indeed. I got some facts about what kind of jobs are really anchoring southeast Minnesota. In the hospitality industry, we have 22,700 jobs as of 2010, generating almost $40 million of sales tax revenue. So I'm thinking, that's significant. What does this whole decision mean to jobs and kind of my businessman hat? And then I go over and I take a look at the WCI report in Wisconsin. In that same period of time, the 8-county area where silica mining has really gotten huge, it produced 77 new jobs. So now my businessman hat's trying to weigh what's more important to the people of Hay Creek. And it started to scare the heck out of me. We currently have 155 acres that was purchased by Muskie LLC, which is owned by Windsor Permian out of Oklahoma. That's owned by Wexford Capital. I think it's out of Massachusetts or Vermont, one of the southeastern states or northeastern states where you don't have to pay taxes. But this is an investment group. This isn't a Minnesota company. And that really is what started to scare the heck out of us. So in our township, we've been working on it for over a year. We did a lot of research, really got to the facts. And we just passed a zoning ordinance trying to protect our trout streams and our bluffs and this environment that attracts these millions of visitors each year, which are the foundation of our economy. But we're scared. I went to a trial hearing the other day over this piece of land that Windsor Permian bought. And they're being sued by a guy by the name of Bob Stein, who used to be, part owner of the Timberwolves. And they had this argument and battle in the court. And afterwards, I'm standing out in the hallway, and somebody said, well, what about this little town of Hay Creek where he bought the land? They just passed a zoning ordinance. And he said, we don't have our boots on the ground yet. They'll find out what a real battle is. I'm asking for your help. Help little townships like mine survive that kind of attack. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fossil. Lynn Schoen.
It's Shane, like Dunka Shane. You'll never forget.
I should have known that, too.
Thank you,
should hear
very
how they
much.
Pronounce my name every now and then.
I'm sure. My name is Lynn Schoen, and I am representing the city of Wabasha, which is only about 2,500 people. Again, this is an emotional issue, especially for us small town people, and I'm going to do my best to paint a little picture of what we've been going through. We recently had a transload facility come in to our town, bullied their way in. It's a Canadian company that, through a lot of legal concerns, pretty much made our city roll over and die because they were afraid of being sued. And through that process, I've really come to look at my community as well and what's important to the people that were born and raised, and I was not raised in Wabasha. I was raised in Hastings, but I'm still a river rat. What's important to those people, and how could I best represent them here? One of the things that I'm trying to explain to people is that where I live is just, if any of you have an antique car or a motorcycle and have made the loop around Lake Pepin, you are familiar with where I live. It is just, it's truly God's country, and it is so beautiful. And we have the National Eagle Center there. I'm wearing a tag that we tag eagles with so we can watch their habitat and make sure they're safe. We get over up to 100,000 visitors every year to our National Eagle Center. 100,000 people from all over the world who are big birders, and the only place they can really be assured of coming is where the Chippewa meets the Lake Pepin meets Mississippi River, and they see eagles galore. So if you've ever been down there, you know what I'm talking about. It's part of the Great River Road. There are thousands of bikers, bicyclers. There are, you know, May we have this 100-mile-plus garage sale. All the way through Oktoberfest, we are tourism, 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 tourism. And in my little city, we have numerous restaurants, bed and breakfast, where you can go rent kayaks and canoes. You can get a trout fisherman to take you back into the backwaters of the Mississippi. We've got trout streams, unbelievable. And it's a different pace of life. It's where people come from Minneapolis and St. Paul to hide, because it's just a different, it's a little tucked away place. One of the concerns I have is where Wabasha is situated, we have the interstate bridge, and a lot of our commerce comes over from Wisconsin, especially in the form of tourism, but also, like in my husband and our business, a lot of our workers come from Wisconsin, a lot of our nurses, a lot of people come over from Wisconsin to work in Wabasha. Now, this transload facility will be bringing up to 900 trucks per day. Now, you put 900 trucks per day, and we've got two rails, CP on one side and Burlington on the other. It's a massive traffic jam waiting to happen. And you tell me that any bicycler and antique car is going to want to fight with 900 sand trucks coming across the bridge. Another concern we have is these guys right now, we're the county seat, so they come and they do their little grocery shopping at our local grocery store. They come to the dentist. They come to our clinic. You know, if you can't get across the bridge, you're not going to be coming to the clinic. And we're looking at the collateral damage, or maybe what the unintended things are. We are highly tourism. We have 700 jobs in Wabasha County alone that are tourism-based. We paid over $1.5 million in taxes from tourism businesses. And now you're saying, okay, we might bring, you know, in our case, maybe 20 truck drivers in. But it might cost us a hygienist and a nurse and a doctor and an anesthetist and all of these things that people aren't going to come through. And I guess what I'm here is I've got all these questions that nobody's been able to answer, because you really don't know how many small businesses will be our collateral damage and how much that this transload facility is situated right in the middle of a residential section. There's houses on both sides. We've got 900 trucks in and out, that diesel that's coming through. It's at the base of the bridge. We've got our big baseball field. Just the way our town is set up, if you don't bypass Wabasha, you're going to scrunch Wabasha completely. And it's a place that is historically one of the oldest places in Minnesota. It's got a lot of historical benefit. It's got a lot of environmental benefit. It's just so full of beauty and wonderful people. So I wanted to just say, you know, I could come up here and talk twice. I could come up here and talk 20 times. I've taken as much time as I can possibly afford away from my little town to come up here and scream, please. I know we're only 2,500 people, and I know it's a small town, but as one of my constituents said to me, why is my daycare business any less important than a sand truck? Why is my restaurant business any less important than a sand truck? So I'm here to try to really implore you to look at other small businesses that this business is impacting. We are tourism related. We like it that way. We don't want anybody to come in and save us. We want you to leave us alone and let us be who we are. We're Wabasha. So thank you for your time, for listening.
Thank you. Senator Scully.
Thank you, and I apologize. I didn't catch your name, but can you...
Shane,
can you,
and Shane, if I'm not mistaken, Shane. In German means nice.
Actually, it means beautiful.
There,
but
okay.
I'll take nice. Nice is good, too.
Ms. Shane, could you talk to me a little bit about why the city of Wabasha is not able to regulate the sand piles that are in Wabasha?
Sure. One thing we were able to do, I'll tell you what we could and could not do. One of the things we were not able to do, the silos where they're going to store the sand is actually being built on railroad property. They're leasing property from the railroad, and they are under the contention that because they're part of the railroad, they don't have to follow any rules because they're federally exempt. Now, good, bad, or otherwise, you're talking small town planner. We have one planner. We have one attorney. We don't have, you know, departments. And so they felt that rather than try to even worry about a lawsuit, we would try to work a few rules that maybe we could protect our wellhead protection. They're right by our wellhead. It's the only one we have. So they did agree to do a few shifts in where they were going to build and how their traffic patterns were going to go. But because of the fear of being sued, quite honestly, they came in, opened their checkbook, said, try to match this, really went into our head administrator and bullied their way through. And it was very frustrating as a small town because we don't have the resources that we need. We didn't know, like now, my residents that I represent are on the west side, and they said, we want to get a baseline. We need to get a baseline air study. Who do we call? How do we get this done? Nobody knows. Nobody has the equipment. We certainly don't have the finances to do it. And we can't even get a baseline air quality set up so we can prove if there's damage or not. It's very frustrating. I got a call this week. The train was over the main neighborhood street going through for over half an hour, and they called the police and said, how do we get our traffic through there? And they go, we don't know what to do. 2,500 people, we're talking small. We have three police officers. We're not talking like, you know, and that's what I'm trying to say. You got to look at this from all of us. It's not just me. It's what happens to me and Lake City and Red Wing, and we're all so connected. And my concern is that cumulative effect and that cumulative bullying. I want to make sure that we have some strong standards set so that we can say, you know, we might be small, but we're not stupid. And we know that we have rights. And you guys got to play by the rules. That's all. Play by the rules.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shane.
Thank you so much.
Amy Nelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amy Nelson. I'm a Save the Bluffs member. I'm also a resident of Hay Creek. And I live adjacent to the proposed sand mine that came to Hay Creek. I got involved in this because it is adjacent to where I live. And where I live is also adjacent to a state forest. And my husband and I hike that state forest a lot. It actually has several paths that walk down to Hay Creek, so we can go out our back door. We can hike through the state forest. We can take the watersheds, follow the watersheds down, and go to Hay Creek. So it's a beautiful, quiet little area. I became very concerned because the land that was purchased actually has two watersheds on it that go into Hay Creek. And when we looked at the bill of sale, it said it was going to be a gravel pit. Well, I couldn't figure out why an oil company was buying a gravel pit. So it started to make my research engine go, when that's my thing, I do research. And I found that that company had said in their quarterly memo that they were going to get $30 million worth of high-quality sand out of that property. I went, oh, well, isn't that interesting? And so it causes you to second-guess what you know. I'd assumed, for example, that there was no such thing as frac sand mine. I didn't even know what it was, actually, but I didn't think anybody would mine it. Well, what I realized was that it really wasn't sand. It was sandstone they were looking for. So they're trying to get at the sandstone. And then I ended up learning, well, to get at the sandstone and get what they want, they use 1/20th of that. The rest is waste. What happens to that waste? Well, then I started to learn that the waste in the processing is what causes the silica dust, which is the stuff that makes you sick. Well, then I ended up following the dust track and found out that, yeah, there is research out there that says ambient dust kills. And it's been out there for 20 years, and it says it kills. So I assumed that our local government would understand that, would see that, and would do something about it. And I was wrong. I was wrong. So we are concerned as citizens, and we're coming to you for help, because although our local government has tightened some rules and put some things in place, they don't have the power to control how much water these companies take, and they will use as much per year as a 500 dairy farm establishment. They don't have the rules or the standards to be able to monitor the air quality to make sure that the air that goes past these mines is safe. And as a cancer survivor, I don't want to get cancer again, and my lungs are susceptible to it. So I'm sorry, I don't want to get it again. So I want that protection, and I want you to help do that. Our county can't do that. And I think probably last but not least with that is I look at our economy and what's already been brought up. Tourism's very important. We rely on that. And I think the other part that hasn't been mentioned yet is we are heavy agriculture. The southeast Minnesota generates over 9,000 jobs a year in agriculture. The area is known for cattle. It's high-quality agriculture, and mining and agriculture do not coexist. They are two separate animals. And if you ask the federal census government, they'll tell you they're two separate animals. So I think we want to protect our agriculture. We want to protect that way of life. We want to protect our tourism industry. We want to protect our air. We want to protect our water. And our local government can't do that. And it's hard to get our county officials in land use to even pay attention because they don't even live in our county. So we need help in establishing some rules at a higher level to do that. And I support the moratorium. I support 786 because, to tell you the truth, we can't do another moratorium in our county. We've got our rules in place at the local level, but our moratorium is about to end at the county level, and I can tell you from looking at what they've done, it's not going to protect us, or it's not going to protect our water. It's not going to protect the level of water in our streams, our rivers. It's going to hurt our barge traffic because of how much water comes out, and it's going to hurt our air. So that's what I'm looking for your help with.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I believe I've seen you in previous committees.
Yes.
Okay. In previous committees, we've heard a significant amount of testimony from the silica sand industry, from the miners, regarding the permitting processes. Mm-hmm. And I've asked the author of the bill of this, and I tend not to get a lot of answers on this one. We've heard all the processes they go through, all of the water permitting that they go through, all the air quality permitting that they go through, that the MPCA is involved, all the agencies that are involved. And I will ask you the same question, and the author could certainly answer this one too. What in the current permitting process is flawed that you see in this permitting of silica sand mining in Minnesota as it currently exists? What do you see? Where do you see a flaw? Where is the problem?
Number one, water. Why are we permitting water to wash sand? Period. We're in a drought. Wisconsin DNR has said that they do not have enough water in the aquifers to satisfy the requirements of the frac sand mining companies. That's number one. So I don't care about permitting of water. I look at it as, why are we giving water to wash sand? We're in a drought. When it comes to air, there's nothing, no standard that protects us against silica dust of 2.5 to 4, period. There's nothing there. There are no state standards. There are no federal standards. There are no standards that say that they're going to protect us. And when you look at what's been happening in Wisconsin and you look at the tests that have been done surrounding the plants in Wisconsin, it's exceeding limits outside of that significantly on occasion, particularly downwind.
Mr. Chair, so then the answer is that you can't identify in the permitting process that silica sand mines go through where a regulatory flaw is involved. Is your answer is you don't know?
Where regulatory flaw is involved? The regulatory flaw to me when it comes to water permitting is, why are we allowing them to permit water to wash sand?
Mr. Chair,
why does that exist?
Mr. Chair, many industries require water, and I guess you're saying that we should exclude one industry, but if, let's say, a gravel pit wanted to be opened, that would be an acceptable one, and they would fill out all the water quality and all the requirements for receiving water, just like any other business. you wouldn't have a problem with that, or a feeder lot or any other industry. You know, I understand your point on being concerned about this industry. However, I will simply state the fact that I have yet to hear anyone say in the existing permitting process where the flaw is that they can't recover from.
Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, I've appreciated your questions every step of the way here. I think this is the third committee that we've been before you with this bill, I think, and I appreciate the questions. I think the challenge here is we know that there's the risk of a lot of activity taking place in a given geography. We just look across the river in western Wisconsin, and what began as just a small handful of mining permit requests a couple years ago has turned into over 100 today. And what we don't know is the cumulative impact of not one mine or two mines, but of dozens of mines in a given region. And the unknown questions that the Environmental Quality Board has identified, and they've spent the last year looking at questions that we need answers to, regard the cumulative impact of this mining on water quality and quantity. I can speak for the trout streams down in southeastern Minnesota. If you take water and you use it and you return it to the stream and it's at an elevated temperature, the trout don't like that. They don't do so well in that situation. And that's not to mention the impacts on the water table or the aquifers that we use for drinking. Secondly, the impact on air quality. I mean, I think Ms. Nelson spoke to the unknowns of silica sand dust in an open environment. We know in a closed environment it can cause silicosis, which is cancer. In an open environment, we just don't know what the result is. That's something that we need to study. And then the third thing is the impact on our local roads with the increased truck traffic. So these are all unknown questions that we need to take time to address. And so those I think merit action in that we've put forth in Senate File 786. Now to the process itself, we currently have in statute a phased and connected activity, and that's basically how one mine relates to another mine relates to another mine. And there's some confusion at the local level, and this is what I hear from folks that I represent, over what that means. And we had a little volley, a back and forth between PCA and health in one of our counties over what should be considered phased and connected. And I think it would do a great service to our local decision makers if we were to take some time to provide further clarity on that matter. So I think it's not just a matter of processes, it's a matter of these unknown questions. And I would just as soon spend the time now dealing with this before the demand for silica sand picks up as we expect it to in the next couple of years. I think it's very possible you could see Wisconsin having to go through much of what we've gone through. But they're in a position where they have 100 mines. It's much easier to deal with this before we get to that stage. And that's why we're taking your time up tonight. And I appreciate your questions. I really do.
Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chair and to Senator Schmidt, I appreciate your comments. I just want to make one additional statement regarding the question on cancer. We understand in a closed environment, to reiterate that point, in a closed environment there are studies and there is information that does support the question of that of silica sand and silicosis being the issue. However, ambient or wide dispersion at very little or minimal amounts of sand or dust has not been proven, has not been studied, and has no current parts per million that tells us whether it is or is not a problem. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, that's correct. Okay. We don't know, we should study it.
Thanks.
Senator, there is one clarification there. There are five epidemiological studies on animal inhalation that show the risk. There are five separate studies on non-occupational silicosis linked to silica, linked to silicosis. And there are two additional studies in which lung disease was found in animals, in one case, one-year-old pigs downwind of significant quarries. The problem is we don't know how much causes that, but we do know that ambient bad silicosis or ambient silica in the air does cause it. We just don't know how much.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I appreciate that, but also keep in mind that there is air permitting and air quality requirements that are standards for silica sand mining as of this moment in time.
Just not off-site, no, only on-site.
You're correct. There are permitting because people work there. We don't want workers to be on-site getting silicosis. we know that people working in these silica sand, this is not a brand new industry. We have seen people in close proximity to silica sand dust, and we already know what those impacts are. I just want you to know that there are air quality standards existing right now, and you agree with that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Who was next? Was Senator, I think Senator Westrum was next, right? Senator Westrum?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, you mentioned 1/20th of what they're mining is what they're after. Can you expand on that a little bit more? This is the first committee that I've really had a serious discussion or testimony on, but what they're after is not a sand in the ground, but sandstone that they crush. But can you explain that a little bit more? 1/20th, and then what they put all the other 19/20ths of the stuff back, or do they just leave it in the pile, or how does that go?
Well, I'll use the industry's information. There's a quote from a couple of Drilling Minerals magazine that I've used in the past. And what they say is this, silica sand deposits are commonly mined for use in glass making, filtration media, blasting media, ceramic products, and fillers, but it's a little bit different. The frac sand industry has more stringent size distribution specification than glass sands, and this can result in more waste product than in this glass sand process. And so if you look, there are four different size classifications, and they have to go with one of those four. There are also five different roundness classifications, and they can only go with one of those. So if you're trying to break it down, you can be as little as 1/20th when you're looking at the different sizes that are within the sandstone, according to the literature that I've read. So I think that depends on the quality of the sand deposit, of course, on how much actually meets their need, but they're looking for a certain grain within that. And when you're looking at the bluffs of southeast Minnesota, you can see certain bluffs. You can actually go up and you can scratch the sandstone and feel it, but they're only looking for stuff that has to be round so it doesn't get caught and lodged during the fracking process, and they're looking for something a certain size. So there's a lot of waste that sits on top of the ground at these sites. And on some of them, it can be piles 90 feet high. Well, they're putting windmills in Goodhue County for a reason, you know. So it kind of means that a lot of that sand can be blown around, and that's part of the worry.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, once they dig those piles out, that's the plan. They just leave them there. They don't reclaim the ground. They just have open pits and never put back what is quote-unquote waste. And
Do they sell some of the other stuff
off to somebody else that might have a different
I can't answer that. I can only look at the pits that I've seen. And some of them, there's huge piles. There's big pits in the ground, and they have both going at the same time. It depends on how much acreage they have to use and what the rules are of that area.
And Ms. Nelson, a couple more questions. You talked about the water they use. Do they discharge it into a different watershed? Do they evaporate it so it's gone? What happens to the water? And I assume they're using it to flush out or clean sand. And do they not just return it to the surface?
There's water that's pumped out of the ground, and that's used to wash the sand, and it's used to try to separate the stuff they want from the stuff they don't want. A lot of that evaporates. A lot of it gets reused. You can only reuse so much of it. So some of it goes back into the ground. Some of it ends up staying in the holding ponds for quite some time. Some of it evaporates. The numbers that I'm giving are assuming that they're reusing 5/5 of the water that they take out of the ground.
Say that again. That presumes what?
That they're reusing 5/6. I'm sorry, I'm going to say that correctly, make sure that I get my quote right. I'm assuming that they reuse the majority of what they put in. So looking at the fact that they end up reusing quite a bit of it. So when you look at the Chippewa Falls, for example, they have 5 high-capacity wells that are permitted. Each well is 3,000 gallons per minute. 5/6 of it's recycled.
5/6. I heard you say 5/5.
So yeah, it didn't make sense, did it?
No.
5/6 of it's recycled, and so that's 2 million gallons per year that's used per well.
Okay, last question for now. So would it be your your testimony in support of these bills, I'm hearing you basically would like us to do something to shut down the silica mining, if we could.
I don't.
Is that right?
I honestly don't think it should be shut down. I think there are certain areas where it could be. It probably does fit really well. I think the problem is there are no standards right now when it comes to how much can be taken in each region. For example, how many can exist in one region? How much water is then taken up in that region? What's the cumulative air quality in that region? Because we aren't talking just one here and one there. If you look at Wisconsin, you can fly over and you can end up spending 10 minutes just crossing sand mines in a plane. So I think it becomes how much is okay. How much water can you take out without affecting the water, the aquifers? How much can be blowing in the air before you end up getting sick? We don't know those answers.
So Mr. Chair, Ms. Nelson, I guess to Senator Osmick's point, would it be different if it was ethanol or vegetable processing plants using the same water? I mean, what is the difference? If we had 15 vegetable processing plants come to your area and want to build, they would use probably as much or more water. Would that be different or not?
I think it might be very different. I don't know the answer to that. I haven't been researching it, and I don't know what that does. I've only been researching this for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But I can say I think we all have to think about the amount of water that comes out and the level of our trout streams and the level of our rivers, and I think you just have to look at White Bear Lake to say that. So I think we do have to think about how much water we're pumping out and what we're using it for, all of us, not just one industry, but I think we all have to look at that.
Thank you.
And Senator Westrum, I don't know if Ms. Nelson considers herself to be an expert on that kind of stuff. But
no, I don't.
She did give us her opinion. So,
yep.
Yeah. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is related to the water issue that Senator Westrum and Senator Osmick brought up. And I live in the area near White Bear Lake. I don't represent that area, but very close. And my business is in White Bear Lake, so it affects me greatly. But my question is, DNR is the permitting agency for water permits for taking out of the aquifer. And we do know that surface water is groundwater. They interchange. What comes from one can go to the other. The question I have is, and I don't know if there's someone from the DNR here who's ready to answer it, but
Senator Scalzi, we should get through the... can you hold this question then? Because I want to kind of get through the public testifiers, and then we can get some people from
right,
the agency.
Right, okay. So my question is going to be any type of monitoring wells. So if the DNR is here, maybe they want to think about it. But monitoring, because we've spent so much money digging wells, and I'm just wondering about this area.
And Senator Ingebrigtsen, is yours about
real quickly, because I think Ms. Nelson sounds like she's been around the block on this and certainly has done a lot of work on this. And my question to her would be, at least her point of view with regards to something that probably everybody sitting at the table here is very concerned about, and that's local. I did this yesterday. Local unit of control. And are you to the point where your local counties are have they had this kind of testimony? No doubt they have over the years. And what kind of guidance have you got from the local unit of government here? I know Senator's got 15 different counties here involved in this study, but what kind of a reaction have you got from your local county boards? Because I know the local county boards sometimes will not say they're gonna pass the buck, but they want somebody else to make their decisions for them. What's your feeling about your local county board with these kind of discussions? Because they certainly are a player here, as well as the city council.
When you say guidance, what do you mean?
Is this a question for Senator Schmidt? Maybe.
Oh, maybe it isn't. We can wait for that. That's fine. Yeah.
I mean, you've given us a pretty good opinion about what you think about. So we don't need to grill you any longer here. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And members, and Mr. Chair, if I could, I don't think we gave Dr. Nelson the respect she deserves.
Well,
so
now you can go back up there. Okay, John Linshewski.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Lincheski. I'm a member of Minnesota Trout Unlimited. I'm not a doctor, so I hope you go easy on me. I'm a sportsman. I represent sportsmen and women and conservationists, and we're...
Are you sure you pronounce that name right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my name is Len Chesky.
Yeah, yes. It looks like Zanzuski to me.
Just like it's spelled.
It's same name as the tax chair in the house. So
that, yeah. I was going to say that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you think I could get that one right, huh?
So, Mr. Chair, members, the mission of Trout Unlimited is to... protect and restore cold water fisheries. And I'll point out, scientists, we talk about this as cold water fisheries, and I want to point out the idea of cold water. If we don't have cold water, we will not have a trout fishery. And in southeastern Minnesota, which is the area we're most concerned about, we have a phenomenal trout fishery, a world-class trout fishery, and just want to, that's why we're concerned here. Ms. Nelson, we know much more about this industry than we really want to. I actually went to the industry seminar last fall, a two-day seminar, and try and get informed about this. And, our position has been that silica sand mining will occur. And we're not opposed to that. Our interest is in protecting these world-class fisheries in the process. So, again, we're really focused on the southeastern corner of the state. They're phenomenal fisheries. It's a very unique ecological region, and I think another testifier will talk about this, karst area. But incredibly productive fishery, incredible economic boon to the area. We did a study. It's about the data is now about 10 years old, but in this driftless area, it covers Minnesota and also southwestern Wisconsin. They pegged the annual... benefit of just trout angling in this area as $1.1 billion, that's billion with a B, from trout angling in this area. So it's getting great national exposure, great national. It's becoming a destination spot to go fishing, and just a huge economic driver. The gentleman from Red Wing kind of alluded to that. So our interest is that we not sacrifice that, not sacrifice the fishery and the thousands of jobs dependent on the area as it exists now. So, that's our interest here, is that we want to do this right. We feel we don't need to sacrifice this. We may need to do a little bit of study and develop some standards that give the industry guidance about places to go where they can be very profitable, get their sand, but it won't impact the resources. So that's what our interest is. Just to give you some perspective, the Minnesota Geological Survey, they did a calculation. They think to supply 40 million tons of silica sand, and that's more than the current demand. We'd need 367 acres a year, 367 acres a year. That's about half a square mile. In the area we're most concerned about, we have 4,000 square miles. So there's plenty of area for the sand. Let's be smart about it. Let's preserve the thousands of jobs while we look to add a few more. So we definitely support this legislation as a means to get this right, keep our existing jobs, keep our incredible world-class fishery while we add other jobs. But I think if we don't use this legislation and these means to get it right, what's the net gain in jobs going to be? We might be a net negative. So again, it's an emerging industry here. They're not really doing silica sand mining in the southeastern corner. They are in the Minnesota River Valley, but in the southeast, they haven't really started doing this yet. And so we have an opportunity to steer them in the right direction. If we act this session, we'll get this moving faster. They'll move to areas where they won't get caught in lengthy environmental review. So I think you'd be doing the industry a favor to say, let's look now without delay, determine some areas, some standards, where you can go and not interfere with the other pieces of our economy, and it's a win-win. So we definitely support this process, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lincheski. Mr. Grubb. Welcome. Say your name for the record, please.
My name is Stuart Grubb. I'm a senior hydrogeologist with Emmons and Olivier Resources. I think on the agenda it says that I'm president of the Minnesota Groundwater Association. I am a past president of the Minnesota Groundwater Association, but not currently.
Okay.
I'm a geologist, so I talk better when I have a map and cross sections to look at and to show. I do have some handouts if somebody would distribute them. I'm here to give some basic testimony about the geologic features of southeast Minnesota and how they relate to trout streams and other natural resources in the area. The area that we're interested in is shown on the first figure here, which is labeled Minnesota Karstlands. We're looking at much of southeast Minnesota that is underlain by carbonate bedrock. In carbonate bedrock, you can develop features that are collectively known as karst, and they're erosional features that are unique to that type of bedrock and that type of landscape. In southeast Minnesota, we also have what's known as the driftless area, which is shown on the following figure. The gray area is an area that was relatively untouched during the last glaciation 10,000 years ago, and so has relatively little glacial material overlying the carbonate bedrock. That is significant because the glacial material tends to protect the carbonate bedrock, prevent erosion, prevent karst from developing, but that is noticeably absent in many areas here. So if you look at the next figure, which is a cross-section of the carbonate bedrock and shows some of the karst features that can develop. And those can include sinkholes, disappearing streams, caverns, caves, and underground channels that carry a lot of water and result in springs that have fairly high capacity. So some of the basics that are important to understand about karst is that it has a what we refer to as a triple porosity, and that's illustrated on the next figure, where we see that there are three ways that groundwater can move through carbonate bedrock. There is a matrix flow, where water moves between the pores. It can flow along fractures that develop quite easily in the bedrock. And it can also form solution channels where we have the underground rivers and caverns and those type of features. The flow through these features can be very fast, can be on the order of miles per day in some cases, which makes these areas particularly prone to and vulnerable to contamination. The figure following that is an illustration of how anything that makes its way into a sinkhole, makes its way into an underground channel, can move very fast and can move very far in a short period of time. The another illustration here shows what sinkholes, channels and caves, and springs look like. Sinkholes are closed depressions that often appear on the surface. Channels and caves, I think we're generally familiar with if you've ever been on a cave tour, either in southeast Minnesota or somewhere else. And springs come straight out of the bedrock in a lot of areas and are often the headwaters or the important tributaries to trout streams. One thing that's important to note about karst features is that even though they're not always visible on the surface, they can be there. Part of the reason that they're not visible on the surface is when they occur in agricultural areas, they are often filled in, plowed over, and relatively obscure. So the fact that there may not be karst features visible on the surface doesn't mean that they're not there. You often need more detailed and specific hydrogeologic testing to identify where they are and where they're going. And last thing I'll say is that these karst features can change very quickly. They are very susceptible to any changes that happen on the surface, whether material is taken off of the surface or whether it's added to the surface. An example that happened a little bit farther north than the area we're talking about, but in very similar situations, was the Dancing Waters stormwater pond. It was in Woodbury, actually. But the picture is shown on the last page, which was an area that where the St. Peter sandstone was excavated to make the stormwater pond down to about the level of the Prairie du Chien dolomite. What happened was the water started flowing through some cracks that had been exposed during the construction and very quickly developed into channels, larger channels, and that pond drained very suddenly one night. So just an illustration of how things can very quickly happen. I also did want to say that the reason that the St. Peter sandstone and the Prairie du Chien limestone and the Jordan sandstone are important for this discussion is that in the stratigraphy of southeast Minnesota, you have the St. Peter sandstone on top, the Prairie du Chien dolomite in the middle, and the Jordan sandstone below that. And of course, the St. Peter and the Jordan are both being considered for frac sand mining, and any mining there will have an effect on the Prairie du Chien dolomite and limestone that is in the middle.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Grubb. Appreciate it. Bobby King. Oh, Senator, you have a
Real question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last page, the sediment pond, the question, I'm not sure in scale how big this is here, but my question would be, where does this water go if it drains? Is it not being filtered back into the aquifer? Is that a fair statement? Or how, you know, what difference would that be, obviously, than a big rain? I mean, a big rain potted up like this would certainly be different, but if it were a steady rain, would it also absorb into the system and be filtered through the bottom of the sediment pond?
It would go through the bottom of the sediment pond. Filtered is probably not the right word to be using. In the case of this picture, if you look closely with the shovel towards the back, there is a hole there that has actually a tape measure sticking out of it, and that was put there to see how far down that crack extended, and it extended at least 25 feet, which was the length of the tape measure. So that opened up very quickly, and water drained through there very fast. That they obviously would not have built a stormwater pond if they had any idea that that kind of thing was there and would develop so quickly. But it did, and that's where the water went.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hold it, Senator Westrum.
Insightful information. I'm just wondering, are you here on your behalf? Is there a group organized that's paid you to give them expert advice? Can you just give us that information?
I was requested to be here on by Trout Unlimited, and the testimony that I'm giving is not necessarily advocating any particular position related to this. It's informational. It was requested that this information be entered into the record.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. King.
Thanks, Jim.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bobby King. I'm with the Land Stewardship Project. We actually had a member drive up from near St. Charles, and I wanted to just make some very brief comments and cede my time to him. Vince Reddy, would that be possible?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Land Stewardship Project support Senate File 786, and we thank Senator Schmidt for all his hard work on this. I know he's been meeting with all sides and trying to put something together that really works. I just want to talk real quickly about the framework of 786 and why we think it gets the job done. You've heard why, for all intents and purposes, this is really a new industry. The scope of it, the size of it, the number of mines in southeast Minnesota would be unprecedented. And I think in your packet you've got a letter from 27 local officials who are really asking for state help. They're using their local control as best they can. But they're saying they want three things, and it's contained in Senator Schmidt's bill. Number one is they want the establishment of some state standards to augment their local control. Air monitoring, water pollution, these are regional issues, and they've seen from Wisconsin that it doesn't work to just address them locally. It has to be addressed regionally. So they want some more meaningful state standards for a new industry. They want an in-depth study like a generic environmental impact statement to figure out what that needs to be. That's in Senator Schmidt's bill, and I do want to say that I think an important part of the bill and the GIS is it's time limited. It's not going to drag on forever, and the recommendations must be adopted by the local units of government. So it won't, I mean, by the state agencies. So it's not just going to collect dust. It's going to result in standards. And lastly, a moratorium so we can get that done. And the moratorium and the standards are not a ban. It's what other folks have talked about, getting it right before we let it go forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Vince Reddy. I'm a retired registered nurse. I live in Saratoga Township. It's just south of St. Charles. We're halfway between Rochester and Winona, to give you an idea of where we are. I raise livestock on a farm there. I've lived there 35 years with my family. Saratoga Township is 5 miles by 5 miles is the dimension. There's a house about every half mile to a mile, and we raise corn and soybeans, cattle, and some draft horses. Until 2 years ago, I didn't know what silica sand was. There's a proposal in our township for 7 mines in an area 2 miles by 5 miles. The seven mines each have put in proposals. The written proposals are for activity from 6 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night to harvest a 20-year supply of sand. 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. each mine is to generate 600 truck trips a day. That's 7 mines, 600 truck trips a day in my township, which currently has no industry. Recently, I drove around my township with a journalist. We drove around for 2 hours. I was showing him where each mine site is, and in 2 hours, we passed 3 other vehicles. The change is just unbelievable to those of us who live there. We would like to know that somebody responsible is going to pursue this activity. I don't know who that is. The responsible group has been labeled as G-Cubed, Minnesota Sands, Minnesota Proppant, and farm to rail. They change frequently. There are a number of investors who kind of shift around and change their name at their convenience. Nobody's giving me any guarantee. We are used to dealing with people face to face and on a handshake. That's not how this industry is. Right now, the families that live here live in a safe, healthy, productive environment. About a third of our township is Amish folks. The other two-thirds are what we call English farmers. The proposed mines, if they start here, our environment, our atmosphere, our resources have changed forever. What was a scenic, safe farming community, rolling hills and pasture, corn and soybeans, will become a heavily industrialized area. I visited the mine sites personally. They're in production in Wisconsin, and I've seen the actual practice of silica production. I'm very concerned about the tremendous traffic and equipment activity and noise, as well as a permanent change to our countryside. A vast majority of the people in our community have signed a petition, and we're trying to arrest the progress of the industry right now. We want to see a statewide moratorium on the growth of silica sand mining in Minnesota. While it's studied, we'd like to find ways to mitigate the effects of this silica industry. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you making the trip.
Thanks, Vince. Thank you. Get home safe.
And finally, I have Tracy Sides. I want to point out we've gone way over the half hour that I said, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We're a little bit guilty for asking questions, so.
So thanks for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 786, and specifically the moratorium generic environmental impact statement and the meaningful state-level standards. I reside in Senator Herr's district in St. Paul, and I've been a Minnesota resident for over 20 years.
Just say your name for the record.
Sure. Tracy Sides. This is my second time now testifying here with this committee, and the second time ever here at the Capitol. Last time, a couple days ago, was because I was an avid bicyclist. And I do love our state's great trails, system of trails. But I'm here today, actually, to share a few observations and opinions, not based on my biking experiences, but on my professional training and expertise in public health. I received a Master's of Public Health in Epidemiology and a PhD in Environmental Health Sciences from the University of Minnesota. I've been a public health professional for 20 years, including serving as a senior epidemiologist at the Minnesota Department of Health and a senior public health analyst at the University of Minnesota. As of last summer, I'm an independent public health professional. I've led collaborative efforts for the World Health Organization, the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Minnesota Department of Health, and county health departments. And over the years, my work has required me to read a lot of lengthy reports and innumerable articles, which I know you guys can well appreciate, mine especially in the medical and scientific literature, and agency position statements and recommendations. I've done a lot of reviewing and synthesizing and looking at things from a lot of different perspectives. So I fully understand that public health itself, as well as policy decisions, are as much about political realities as they are about science. And my work, like I said, has always required me to understand issues from many different perspectives. One little feather in my cap is that in a previous position, I had the challenging task of wrangling policy language consensus among the FBI, EPA, CDC, and the Department of Homeland Security for national guidance documents. I'm happy to say that was with success, but with several more gray hairs for the undertaking. So I don't envy your task before you. This is the frac sand mining issue is incredibly complicated, and it's not just about sand mining jobs or health. It's about sand mining jobs and health and safety and water quality and trout streams and land use and infrastructure and taxes and local economies and behavior of commodity markets and evolving oil and gas extraction technologies. And I will not be speaking to all of those aspects tonight, so don't worry. I'm going to keep mine limited in scope to respirable crystalline silica. So first, based on my review of numerous documents, opinions, and studies, it's my professional opinion that from an environmental health standpoint, that the scale and the intensity of the proposed industrial silica sand mining operations pose substantively different exposure potentials for nearby residents than previous smaller-scale silica sand mining operations. As mentioned in formal comments by the Minnesota Department of Health in February of this year, that agency has, quote, little to no information on the levels of respirable silica generated by frac sand mining or processing. And that's not because they're not doing their jobs. It's because there is no body of scientific work out there to inform that. As Senator Schmidt argues, we need to get this right. And this has been brought up, but I'm sure you're probably well aware that respirable crystalline silica is a group 1 human carcinogen as determined in 1996 by the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer. And as a separate disease, silicosis has been recognized for decades to be caused by exposure to respirable crystalline silica, which is an incurable but preventable disease. So rapidly evolving industries involving hazardous materials are challenging at best for agencies whose mission is to protect worker health and safety, and separate agencies, often for the health and safety of the community. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which is responsible for setting and enforcing standards to assure a safe and healthful workplace, cannot keep up with characterizing silica exposures in an evolving workplace, let alone the National Center for Environmental Health at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control to try and characterize community-level exposures. They're behind the ball on this because it's such a rapidly emerging industry, both the hydraulic fracturing as well as the industrial silica sand mining. I want to draw your attention to a recent study that was completed by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. Their charge is to do the research and make recommendations for the prevention of work-related injury and illness. And then OSHA usually will adopt those recommendations to set the permissible exposure limits. So in 2010, with industry partners, NIOSH initiated the field effort to assess chemical exposures in oil and gas extraction workers. And this was done at 11 sites, and it was because there were very few data regarding occupational health hazards during hydraulic fracturing operations. And when that team went there and did an initial hazard assessment, they identified not the chemical exposures, but actually exposure to crystalline silica during the hydraulic fracturing process as the most significant known health hazard to workers. And that became the focus of the NIOSH study. In those results were just recently, and I can leave some of this literature if it's helpful. This is a description from 2010 of the effort to do the study. And then in May of 2012, just this past May, the results of that study were published by NIOSH. And in short, the exposures to respirable crystalline silica consistently exceeded relevant occupational health criteria, which includes the OSHA permissible exposure limit, the NIOSH recommended exposure limit, which is half, actually, of where the OSHA 1974 OSHA standard currently is. And some of these were as much as 10 times the occupational health limit.
Can you kind of wrap up?
Okay. So when they do those things, they'll then identify engineering or other sorts of controls to help limit those exposures. And there were seven primary points in that the use of silica sand in the hydraulic fracturing process. And then subsequent to that, they identify the points and then what are the measures that would be involved. And the first recommendation was use a less hazardous non-silica proppant.
I don't think we're concerned about fracking the fracturing process itself.
Okay. It is coming full circle because what the that's kind of important that the hydraulic fracturing industry, which is relying on the silica sand that we're talking about mining, it's not a slam dunk that they're going to use silica sand for one. And that context of this evolving federal level, OSHA level picture, they don't even understand what's fully happening. And so there's this ongoing regulatory interest about silica in the workplace in these evolving industries. And we haven't even really looked at workers here. Personally, I'm concerned about our workers on this larger scale, but I'm definitely interested in the potential community exposures, which we don't know about, and we need to look at that before we go down this road.
Okay. So. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could, you've been very generous with the testimony. I was just informed that we had somebody drive up a long ways. They'd like no more than 2 minutes just to say something that has not been said yet tonight.
Oh, I doubt it. But come on.
Mr. Chair, we'd like to prove you wrong. Here goes.
Who is it? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I'll give it a shot.
All right. Say your
name for the record, please. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amanda Griggs. I think this is maybe my seventh trip up here to the Capitol to support Senator Schmidt's file 786. I even went to the EQB meeting, and I've been reading a lot and studying a lot. And I just wanted to bring up a few points that I believe have not been touched on and some of the questions that have come up. First of all, I just don't think that there has been enough emphasis on Southeast Minnesota. We have never had industrial scale mining. We just have very small gravel
pits. That point was brought up.
Well, the problem is that on the local level, people are asking, what about the local governments? I go to all the county meetings. I go to the township meetings. These people don't even know what hydraulic fracturing is, and they don't even know what the difference is between gravel and frac sand. That scares me. And these are the people who are making decisions about my health. I'm just wondering, and I'd like to ask the question, what is wrong with taking a conservative approach on this and taking the time to do the study? Our climate is changing. I believe that water is more gold than the silica sand that we're looking at mining, and that I would like all of you to help us in southeast Minnesota and the whole state of Minnesota to protect that water. I think we're coming into times that are changing. And then with the silica sand and the carcinogenic effect, sometimes it takes 30 to 40 years. We had a doctor come and do a presentation. In a lot of the mining industries of the past, these things did not show up for 30 years. It's very hard to do a study on something that doesn't come into full fruition for 30 years. So it's very complicated. In my county, there's two new commissioners that know absolutely nothing about frac sand. And so there's this change of the guards. And so it's very difficult to get a whole lot done on the local level lately. And what is different about using water to wash vegetables and what is different in using water to wash silica sand is a flocculant. One thing that was not mentioned is they're mixing this water with a flocculant that helps to separate out the good from the bad. This is not well studied. There are effects of it being in the sun. And in Wisconsin, there are two incidences, and this was a hiker. This isn't even the DNR finding this out. And this is why I support his bill, is we need people watching on this, that this water with flocculants were leaked into rivers and streams. Our drinking water, our trout streams, this is a dangerous situation. That's what's different about it. And just overall that our climate is changing and just the fact that the sand is going into another place nationally that is ruining people's water as well. So I thank you for your time, and I just really would like our government here up in Minnesota to take the time to do these studies. And, you know, it isn't a ban, but taking the time to be conservative and look over our health and our environment and the future of our children is the right way to go.
What if these studies come out and say it's okay to do this mining? What would you say then?
Well, I would be very surprised in the Driftless area if that was the case. But what would I say? Well, good. I'm glad that you did the studies and you did the right thing. And I would thank you for taking that time.
Thank you very much. We have let's bring two people up to the table at the same time. Scott Sestanchik and Matt Bryan. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record, and you can go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Sestanchik. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Jordan Sands. We're a startup sand mining operation in Mankato. We're part of Coughlin Companies, which has a 125-year history in Mankato. The company started mining limestone in that town before it was even a town. And so the town has kind of grown up around a number of our quarries. Our owner, Bob Coughlin, who's probably listening in, if this is on, would call me remiss if I didn't remind the committee that his grandfather provided the limestone out in the corridors out here. And so we're a longstanding Minnesota business.
Darren Range paid for it, too.
Well, we think. So there's a lot to be thankful for around the table here. We also have a large business here called Capstone, which is a children's book publishing business. Our owners happen to be serial entrepreneurs, and we employ about 300 people here in the state of Minnesota. We have come forward with a mining and processing proposal because the limestone business through the recession has been a significant challenge, and so unfortunately we've had to shed jobs in that business. Our mine and what we're trying to start with is relatively small. It's a 70-acre mining that has gone through an EAW process. We're about 75% complete with that. With all the mining that we've done in the Mankato area, we've developed a close working relationship with Lyme Township, the City of Mankato, Blue Earth County, as well as the various state agencies. Minnesota, and it may not be well known yet, with this group, we've testified on this at a number of hearings, but Minnesota has a long history of large-scale sand mining. We're home to one of the largest industrial sand companies in the world. And obviously the Mankato area, the Minnesota River Valley, is historically a mining area. Our operation will be in and around active mines and quarries for aggregates and limestone. There's a working landfill, an active landfill, an old landfill, and a large-scale metal processor in the area that we're trying to permit. We've taken our properties through environmental assessments before for limestone mining and simply want to go deeper to get the sand. When we start our project, it'll create 35 jobs, and these are our $20 to $25 an hour jobs before benefits. If we can keep growing the business, we expect it to ultimately employ 70 people with those kinds of living wages that are put your kids through college kind of dollars. We support, in through this process, we support strong state control. And, in fact, we have worked closely with state agencies. And, in fact, today I was with the Minnesota Department of Health, and they indicated that they'll have an ambient air. They don't call it a standard at the Department of Health, but a guideline out by the middle of the year, so sometime this summer. We volunteered to put our project into ambient air monitoring, so that the MPCA and the Department of Health can begin to collect the data that they say they sorely need to really monitor this closely. And then we support technical assistance for those communities and those RGUs which don't have the knowledge and skill set within their organizations to permit these mines. And so we're very much in favor of that. The DNR, the Department of Health, and the MPCA have been very active in our permitting process thus far. And we've had very good working meetings with them where we have taken their input as well as their comments on our project, and it has ultimately made our project better and will make our project stronger going forward. To close, you asked specifically, Mr. Chair, where do we stand on the two bills? In 786, we would say not really necessary, coming on the heels of this state just permitting over a 1,000-acre mine. Le Sueur County issued this permit not less than 60 days ago. We certainly think that a moratorium or GIS, given that we have RGUs and government units that can move large-scale permits like that through confidently, with the support and with the backing of state agencies, would be a step backward. 1018, we think, has some merit, and especially as it talks to the technical committee. And as we've said all along, Senator Schmidt and I see eye to eye that this state has some great quality sand. And I've testified before that really that sand is Minnesota's opportunity to participate in the energy revolution going on around this country. And I think, you know, given the nature of this industry right now, companies that bring these projects forward, the Unimans of the world, the Great Plains Sands, the Merriam Junctions, need to be responsible companies. And you need to work with the state agencies and your local government to make sure that the project can be sustainable and fit into the communities that these are going into. They don't fit everywhere. With that, we urge you to weigh these matters carefully as you debate them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Bryan. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Bryan Rock Products. I'm a fourth generation. My brother is also fourth generation, family-run organization in limestone. Several years ago, we discovered below our limestone that we had a substantial, high-quality reserve of silica sand and began the process of developing that. In that process, due to our size, we determined that, and due to law, we would be doing an EIS, an Environmental Impact Statement, which is a site-specific detailed study of our site. It studies all the important things that a lot of people have touched on today: dust, water, air, noise, reclamation. I could go on and on a lot of these. And and 2 years ago, we started developing that. We started doing the studies. We started investing money. And to date, we've invested nearly $2 million into this study. That is still not necessarily complete. During that time, our RGU, which is Scott County, we've worked also with the township we're in developing the EIS. During that time, we took our draft and the different sections and sat down with the county and went over these sections. And those sections where the state agencies had either permitting authority or expertise, we met with them, such as DNR for water, Department of Health for water, MnDOT on our traffic, MPCA on air and water. And we've gained a lot of good knowledge on our project and on the effects and different things we need to study in our project. Scott County just recently, last year, approved an IUP, an interim use permit, for Great Plains Sands, a silica mine just south of us. Interim use permit similar to a CUP, except for it's an interim. That means that during the process, if the county can open that permit up, if things are found, even in our EIS, that they can apply to Great Plains Sands IUP. The MPCA also, if standards change, can open air permits and change those standards. Like Scott, we support strong state standards. We're not trying to skirt standards. We're just trying to operate under the standards that exist. We look forward to the Department of Health and the PCA developing an ambient air standard. It really helps us when we're developing these projects to know how to develop the projects, how to build the projects, how to design them so they're most not only acceptable to the state but are efficient for our neighbors. We've been operating in Scott County in the same area we wish to mine for 60 years. During that time, we created a lot of good relationships with people, and we'd like to continue that. And it's important to us to continue that. And we really look at this as just an extension of the future of our company, which has been mining for 72 years. Majority of what you've heard on the opposition side are from southeast Minnesota. You don't hear the opposition from the Minnesota River Valley or Jordan Sands and Merriam Junction Sands. Due to the regional nature, we feel that the moratorium and the GEIS just don't apply because we're doing an EIS on our project. And during our EIS, we're not allowed to operate in any way. And it's site-specific, and it really gets to the details of our project. And so we are under a GEIS technically. We're doing an EIS. We're under a moratorium. We can't operate while we're doing that. And it really will study individually our site and do the best, and will develop the best standards and operating procedures that are important for our site.
Senator Westrom.
I'm sorry.
No. Oh, you're done? I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
I thought you were done. Are you done?
Yeah, I can be.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Senator Westrom.
Well, to that issue.
Keep going if you want.
can you clarify, are you doing silica sand mining in the Minnesota River Valley now? Is that what you're saying?
We are currently limestone mining in Minnesota River Valley, and we wish to mine below that limestone where the sandstone exists. So it'd be in the same area that we're limestone mining below that dirt, below that deposit. Excuse me.
But to the prior testimony, what you're planning to mine is not something you have mined. So is there dust and new elements that are gonna come out of that that you don't have experience with?
Well, for the most part, the mining and things are very similar. The wet processing is very similar. The things that were a little different than we're used to would be the drying and the sorting of it, and then the storage. But that's all studied very stringently in during our air emissions section of our EIS. So those sections will be covered. Those are things that we're looking forward to standards on. But yeah, there are certain aspects of the project that would be new, but to the mining and the wet process, it's very, very similar to what we've done.
I'm sorry.
I'll ask this and then go ahead. So you're in the Minnesota River Valley, not quite as far southeast as some of the proponents of the bill were talking about.
Correct.
But mining a similar product.
Correct. We're just south of Shakopee, just south of 41 in an industrial zoned area in Louisville Township. Correct. We're farther north than Jordan Sands, actually, also.
In Jordan Sands, are you in the southeast area?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, we're in the Minnesota River Valley, just north of Mankato. And I think to answer your previous question about dust, as part of our air quality permit from the MPCA, we also submit a fugitive dust plan to the MPCA that we need.
A what?
Fugitive dust plan.
Fugitive.
That we need to run our business by in the event that stockpiles become too dry. We're monitoring the moisture content to ensure that dust doesn't become airborne. It becomes part of our business plan and operation.
And so what do you do, sir, if they become too dry?
Water them.
And we will be both our projects will be monitoring air along that time. So we'll be constantly be monitoring and checking to see where we're at. And so if conditions exist, then we will adjust our fugitive dust, ambient dust plan.
And that's all part of your current permit process?
Mr. Chair, gentleman. Senator Westrom, correct.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, we heard tonight that there's a lot of RDUs that, whether they be commissioners or townships, that aren't able or don't understand the processing when you come for the permitting process, and they don't have the knowledge of that issue. But I heard you say that you provide technical assistance for these RGUs. Could you just expand on that and tell me how you help them through the process?
Senator Tomasoni, mm-hmm. or Commissioner Senator Rudd, I believe what we talked about is there's a technical assistance component in Senator Schmidt's bill, and so that the where this bill would call for, if an RGU or local government needed that, they would be able to access that from the state.
Senator Rudd.
And Mr. Chair, is that in 1018? Is that?
Which one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rudd, that provision, actually, the technical assistance team, it was in 786 from the get-go, and it's also gained traction in the House and the Senate in 1018. So that's an element of both bills that I hope folks would agree is essential.
What does gaining traction mean? Is it in the bill or isn't it?
It's in the bill.
All right.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
It's in the bill. It's in both.
Okay, Senator Rudd.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt, So in 1018, that does help our local units of government deal with the technical issues that they don't have the expertise to do themselves.
Mr. Chair and Senator, that provision's in both bills, so yes, it would.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. okay, to the testifiers here, you are both seeking permits at this point in time, correct? And I know that you indicated that you were in the over 2 years. What is your best guess at this point if the status quo remains and you continue through the process from the time you applied to when you would expect to have that permit and be operating? Both of you.
I'm going to go first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, that's really a function since most of our studies are relatively complete, it's turning those in and going through the comment period and going through. We would hope that if on the track run we're looking at no later than sometime at the end of this year, beginning of next year. But that's also a function of what the comment period looks like.
So then if you've been at 2 years, you're looking at roughly a three-year period?
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, we've gone through an environmental assessment worksheet, which we started last July, and we anticipate permits August, September timeframe. Okay. All goes according to plan.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the requirements for you to go through the various processes and permit functions that you're going through were originally set up by your respective counties. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, the environmental guidelines that we're following, I believe, were from the state level.
They were from the state, okay.
And determined by the project size.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. If we can have Jason George and Kathy Haney come up. Kathy here. You don't look like Kathy Haney.
No, and I'll never be as smart and as good looking as Kathy Haney.
That's a good answer.
She owes me for that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Coles. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just a couple of brief comments very quickly. As you've heard from the two previous testifiers, this isn't an industry that's just showing up in this state. It's been here for over 100 years, and we're on to the second, third, and fourth generation of some of these family-owned shops. It's one of the most also heavily regulated existing industries in the state, I would argue, between townships, cities, counties, and at the state level. And it employs, as Mr. George will point out, hundreds of good-paying union jobs here in the state. As a matter of fact, Greater Mankato Chamber of Commerce did an economic impact study, and for every job created at that facility down there, it spun off 1.8 jobs in the local community, whether those folks were eating at restaurants, getting gas at the local gas stations there, eating at the restaurants. And a couple other things to keep in mind, too. This industry, it's been around not – all of this sand is not going for hydraulic fracking throughout the United States. This sand has been around, like I pointed out, has been around. Some of these facilities have been around for over 100 years. The end product is being used in windshields, in glass, in ceramics. It's used in the livestock industry for bedding for dairy cows. Mm-hmm. So just keep that in mind as you go through. And each facility is unique in itself. We can't boilerplate it in a one-size-fits-all. They're all differently set up. Some of them are processing. Some of them are just mining. So just keep those in mind in your deliberations as we go through. But I think there's a way to do this. I think there's a way to promote the economic development, that the potential that is there, but also find that a unique balance to protect the environment and natural resources of this state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. George.
Mr. George, you're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Jason George. I'm the legislative director for the Operating Engineers Local 49. We have about 13,000 members, heavy equipment operators in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. Just to be clear right off the bat, we strongly oppose a moratorium and a statewide environmental impact statement. We believe both are detrimental to jobs, our jobs, my members' jobs in the state. And for a few reasons. I mean, I'll talk more about jobs. One thing I want to clear up sort of right away is something I heard mentioned before, is that in Wisconsin they created 77 jobs in this industry. As Senator Schmidt pointed out, there's been about 100 new mines in the last 4 or 5 years in Wisconsin, which is true. My heavy equipment operators are highly skilled, Mr. Chairman, but it's hard for me to imagine that 77 of them could operate 100 mines successfully. So I'd just like to point that out for the record.
Point well taken.
I'll give you one other statistic on jobs. Uniman Corporation has been mining silica sand in Minnesota for a long time, and they employ 200 people. 100 of those are my operators. 100 of them are steel workers. So that's a sense of what we're talking about here. We believe this industry can create, if given the chance, hundreds of good-paying jobs in rural Minnesota. These jobs, just to give you a sense, pay about $45, $50 an hour total package. That includes family health care paid for by the employer, pension paid for by the employer. These are among the best jobs in rural Minnesota, period. So that's what we're talking about. As far as the reasons given for why we can delay or maybe why we should take some time, let me give you a couple reasons why we shouldn't. One is other states, many other states, and more every day are finding silica sand in their states, and they're developing it. They're moving forward. We fall farther and farther and farther behind. As you've heard, these folks have spent 3 years trying to get a permit already. A year moratorium just completely shuts that, doesn't shut it down, but it really delays it, significant delays. The other reason, more significant to me and to my members, is that we've lost 50,000 construction jobs since 2005 in this state. So how much longer can they wait is my question. We need these jobs in the state. Mining is a huge part of our state. We believe this will help those 50,000 people maybe come back to this industry. And we urge you to oppose a moratorium or a GEIS and go with something along the lines of what the technical advisory committee that gives the local communities the help that they need, that is moving in the House, and we support that approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Senator Osmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quillis, just one simple question. We have such high-quality sand in the area that's being described. That will also be able to be used in PV cells for solar panels, correct?
Oh, no.
That's a good question, Senator Osmick, and I could get back to you on that. I apologize that in my research I did not catch up on solar panels, but that might be a good possibility for use of that.
Senator Scalzi.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering about the truck jobs. I understand the operating engineers, but if you've got 900 trucks a day in one case or 600 trucks a day, trips one day in another case, are those union jobs as well? Does anyone know from the table there?
Mr. George.
Some of those are. Not all of them are. The vast majority of the heavy equipment operator jobs, which is my main concern, are union jobs. We do have some truckers as well, and I know there's some Teamsters that get jobs out of this industry too.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if Mr. George is the right one to answer this. If not, maybe somebody else is. One of the earlier testifiers talked about an ever-changing name of who's doing this. We've just had two companies come forward. I don't know if they're changing their name that often, or do you know anything about that? I mean, who's doing these projects if they're changing their name? I'm puzzled on that statement, and that I was led to believe we don't really know who's buying these mines or who's going to do the mining.
You know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I believe that the previous testifier was referring to Minnesota Proppants or Minnesota Sands, which was a group of investors, some from Wisconsin, some from Minnesota, that were trying to develop the single largest sand mining operation through a number of satellite mines and then one processing facility, I think, in or near St. Charles. Mm. And I believe that project really went through a lot of challenges, and then the MPCA and the Minnesota Department of Health both came out with very strongly worded letters indicating that project should go through an EIS as opposed to separate EAWs. And I don't know what's happened to those project proposers or if they'll come forward with an EIS.
And Senator Schmidt, EIS because one company was running that many mines versus a smaller operator. Let me just say Jordan Sands, it sounded like a smaller operator that they would only be using one mine and another company would be doing another mine.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, this is a great question that you ask, and this is really getting to the heart of the challenge that we currently face. We talk so much about our current regulations and our processes. This points to the insufficiency of those processes, because right now you could have, you know, a collection of mines in a given region, and if they're if they don't meet the threshold in terms of acreage to trigger an EAW or an EAS under current law right now, they wouldn't necessarily have to follow either approach. And the concern is all we have right now is the threat of a strongly worded letter. And I think that we got to do better than that. And we've got to have clarity in terms of what our agencies can expect, what we're indicating to local decision makers in terms of an EAW or an EIS. I think that's that whole phased and connected notion that we talked about earlier. And I think that we need more clarity on that. And so I think that we'd all benefit if we were able to take the time right now and determine what is phased and connected, what's meant by that, and what are the appropriate thresholds for an EAW or an EIS. And I think that's why we're here. I mean, because that proposed project in St. Charles, it could have very well have gone forward. The problem is it may have gone forward without an EIS, and I don't think that would benefit any of the stakeholders involved. So that's why we're here.
So Senator Schmidt, are there smaller projects right now that don't have to do EIS because they're just one mine or they're a smaller number of acres that they're going to mine?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, that's exactly right. Right now, the current categorical thresholds that would trigger an EAW are 40 acres, and 168 acres would trigger an EIS. Right now, you could have a collection of mines in a given geography, and if they're treated as separate and not phased and connected, you could have them all go forward, none of them triggering an EAW or an EIS, and you would never take into account the cumulative impacts of those mines in that region. So that's what we want to take the time to really explore and to provide some clarity on.
Doesn't the local unit of government have some say on whether or not there's an EAW or an EIS?
Well, you heard it here. I mean, all we got was a strongly worded letter, and I think from state agency encouraging local units to take them into account in a certain way. So I think that's the kind of back and forth we want to avoid. We want to be able to move forward, and if the demand for silica sand picks up in the years ahead, we see more permitting requests coming in. Our local decision makers and our state agencies are on the same page in terms of what we should expect: EAW versus EIS, or maybe neither, if that's the case.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Sansom.
Senator Westrum, that project ultimately, the EQB was named the RGU for that particular project. In fact, I was at that meeting where the EQB voted to become the RGU on that project. And so they are the ones now responsible for it. And so that, again, that is part of the state process that's currently in place that local governments do have access to.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I have something called neutral testifiers, which I'm not sure what that means, but we'll find out here. Kent Sulem, are you still here, Kent? Anna Lee Garlett and Craig Johnson. I don't know how much time I should give to neutral.
We'll be very brief.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'll be very brief and we'll not repeat each other, I hope. So, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. We are up here just to let you know that, first of all, to thank the author. He's spent actually a tremendous amount of time working with local governments to make sure our concerns in these two pieces of legislation are addressed. And Anna Lee is going to talk a little bit more about that. The reason we come up kind of as neutral commenters on this is because really what local governments are looking for, and many members around the table have already commented on this tonight, is three things. We want to make sure that we preserve our ability to make the right decisions for our communities. That's our job as local governments, to look at the situation where we are and what works best in our areas for our constituents as local governments. We want the state to provide us with the technical assistance and scientific support that we need to have those decisions well made. This is not an issue that all of our local governments have a background in. And so having that resource of the state agencies well prepared and ready to assist makes it so we can make good, sound decisions using good science and good process. And we need the resources available to deal with the infrastructure and public service impacts of having these kinds of industries come into our communities. So our comments that we've been working on with the author on this are in relation to those issues. That's really our three things that we've been working on, and we feel the bills are moving in the right direction to address those.
What direction are the bills moving?
Mr. Chair, the language in the bills is moving in the right direction for addressing our concerns. But that might be a better way to put it.
We have two different bills here, and it sounds like the moratorium is controversial, and it sounds like the GEIS is controversial. And so I'm just wondering if you have a position on those or not. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Lee Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And as Craig indicated, we have been working with Senator Schmidt on the language in both bills as it relates to the advisory team and the resources provided. Those are things that we have heard from all of our local governments that we work with as resources and science that we feel are needed. So that's what we've been commenting on at this time. We're continuing to have discussions about the language in 786 with Senator Schmidt, and we'd be happy to include you in some of those discussions as we move forward. I know that we're meeting with you tomorrow to have more discussion on the advisory team. To date, we have not been commenting on the GEIS, as we are neutral on that.
Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And the only thing I would add is just while we have not weighed in specifically on the GIS or the use of a moratoria, should the committee decide that those should be in the omnibus bill, we would ask that no preemption language is included. That was an initial concern that we had that the senator has graciously worked with us on. But there are ways, and past experience has taught us that those tools frequently result in preemption concerns, and so we would just encourage that should the committee move forward with that there not be any preemption language.
Any questions of these witnesses? Senator Scalzi, your hand is up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question was before, somebody's got a bigger checkbook, so we can't say no, and I'm just kind of wondering, we've kind of had this question here amongst us. So a city, say Wabasha, who is a member of the League of Minnesota Cities, possibly insured by the trust. If they said no to a company, there would be an insurance policy that would be backing them up. But then, and if that's not correct, you can correct me. But my question is then, for a county or a township, do you have such a mechanism? What if a township said, no, we don't want to have a sand mine in my township, and they get sued by the company, then what happens?
Mr. Chair.
Sulem.
Senator Scalzi. We also have an insurance trust. We do not represent 100% of the townships. There are those who go off and get their own policy elsewhere, but we do have approximately 94%, I'd say, that are insured through us. We do have an insurance rider for land use that we ask that they acquire. So like any insurance company, we'd evaluate the nature of the claim to make sure it was covered. But we do have – our program is modeled almost identically after the league's program, so we would be providing that. We also do extensive training, which is why we are asking for this assistance with the task force, because we do have to tell our members that when you do zoning, I always start my legal workshops off saying zoning is what everybody wants done to their neighbor, not to themselves. Let me have free use of my land.
Sounds like tax increases.
Correct. Yeah. And so we have to tell our folks to be, you know, make sure they get as much good information. Don't respond to the promise of millions of jobs. Don't respond to the not in my backyard. Get the facts, do your own research, and make an informed choice. And we believe that's where the senator is trying to take us.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, counties additionally have the Minnesota County Insurance Trust. It is not part of the Association of Minnesota Counties, but we do similar education and encouragement and, again, education of helping people make proper decisions when they are making these decisions on permits.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you raise your
hand? Yeah, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple questions with the local units of government. Did you have a standard I see they have different counties here that have done some resolutions. Does the counties and the cities all come together? I know they do every year. And have they come together as a local, not local, I guess, statewide organization in support of this? Or are you saying it's neutral? And a couple other questions I would have would be with regards to weight restrictions, class roads. You mentioned that, of course, along with this kind of stuff comes some infrastructure issues when you start talking different class roads. And I would like to know where you stand with that. I know this is 15 counties, Senator, I believe, of the 87 counties. Do all 87 counties go along with this moratorium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, is that directed to me here?
Either.
Yeah, I mean,
where it comes from.
To your question, what we've done in Senate File 786 is we've identified the 15 counties in southeastern, south-central Minnesota that there are likely to be sand mining if they're not already. And that's what this bill is applicable to. The statewide moratorium, however, as proposed, is statewide and would affect all counties.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add very quickly on the road piece, that is a major concern at the town level. I believe the senator to your left would love to be able to say, here's a fantastic transportation finance bill. We've been advocating very hard for such a package that would make it better for all land uses if we could succeed in getting that. But there seems to be a little hang up on gas tax, which is what trickles down to us and would make a lot of these concerns be able to be addressed.
So my question still remains, is it being it's a statewide moratorium, Senator, is it got the full support of the counties, I guess the 87 counties? Or are they going to stay neutral? Because if this were to happen for this particular type of mining, the risk is always there for another one, and it should be if it's called for. But I'm just wondering where the total 87 counties stand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, AMC has not weighed in on this provision.
Okay. I guess you guys are excused unless somebody else has any questions. Go ahead.
I can just say on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, we did discuss this issue in the interim in our policy committees. What we took as our essential approach to this is the three points that I raised at the beginning, that our concerns with this are to make sure that the local control is preserved, that we get the resources we need to deal with the infrastructure and other public service access, and that the state provide us the information we need to not end up making bad decisions. That's what our organization took as their position. They did not take a position on either the GEIS or the moratorium.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Just to follow up real quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. For the local units of government, this is a very large committee. We're talking one from each county or, you know, one from each city, one from each city that's either in a permitting process or has a permit. We all know how well we get along on different issues here, and we're a relatively small committee. This is a 30-plus member committee. Do the county or city units have an issue with that at all, or more the merrier?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is something that we have been discussing with Senator Schmidt, is about the size and the makeup of this particular committee. As Mr. Johnson indicated, what we do want is a product that we can use, and some solid guidance and some expertise at the state level. And so we want to make sure that there's something that ultimately is useful across local government lines that come out of this. And so that's what we've been engaged in discussions with Senator Schmidt about, is how do we get this product out there for use with these local governments. But this is something that I have heard from a number of counties about, is how exactly the board that's set up in here with the number of townships and cities and counties that would all be on it, and how do all of these individuals, 30 plus, sit down and come up with a model ordinance. So that is something that we have been discussing with Senator Schmidt and hope to keep discussing tomorrow.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, just to reiterate, this would be an optional board. You don't have to be a member of it. If you see value in it, you could join it. And I would not expect that all the counties that have been identified would choose to find value in this process, just by virtue of the fact that they're not sand mining in those counties, and they may not be in the immediate future.
I just saw something that I find pretty interesting in the definition of mining. That mining means mining, is kind of what it says here. So it says mining means excavating and mining silica sand by any process, including digging, excavating, mining. So, I mean, I'm not sure what that definition means, but it scares me, just so you know, because I know what mining is up in my area, and then I start wondering, does this mean the mining in my area? And then I start really worrying, because I know what we're going through when it comes to EISs and all kinds of different things. Like, do you have any wild rice down in your area? Because if you do, you've got a real big problem.
You know, Mr. Chair, we actually do have wild rice down in southeast Minnesota. And, you know, as you put together your omnibus bill, I'll tell you what, you can define mining however you like as it pertains to silica sand. So.
I did have a question.
Senator Scull, you had a question of the
about
DNR.
Water
did you ever get answered in the process here, or do you want? Is there anyone from the DNR who heard Senator Scull's question? And
Mr. Chair, it did not get answered.
Okay,
as they're coming up, my question is related to monitoring wells. And as you know, we've installed a number of monitoring wells through the state, paid for through the general fund, through our budgeting process, taxes, and also some have been paid for by Clean Water Legacy money, which is a sales tax. My question is, these monitoring wells are all over the state. I know there's one in Edina that's been there for 65 years. So they've got a good body of knowledge as far as the level of the aquifer and the fact that it's going down. My question is, in this area, is there any knowledge, have there been any monitoring mines in the general area that would tell us what's happening with the aquifer related to agriculture and people and the use of the water, and if it's going up or if it's going down, or what would we use as a base level of knowledge for this?
Mr. Chairman, members, Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Water Resources Director. We do have monitoring wells scattered all over the state. As you've probably heard, we don't have nearly the number we need to really track the overall level and health of our aquifers. But the other point I would bring up, I think that's important here, is that when you're talking about a specific operation like a proposed sand mine, oftentimes you need to have a monitoring well that's specific to that area, that's site-specific, so you can get detailed information in that immediate area. So you might have an area where you've got some monitoring wells set up to track the general levels of the aquifers and still need monitoring wells that are specific to that project.
Senator Scalden.
Another question on this would be, what would be the process and what would be proposed to make sure, I don't know how we can find out what the level of the water is in the groundwater. And as a second part to that, why can't we use river water that's in the area?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scalzi, the answer to your first question with regard to monitoring wells, if we've got an application for a water appropriation permit, then we can make the installation of a monitoring well a condition of that permit. So we might actually, and we often have to do that for larger operations like a proposed sand mine. With regard to the second question, I don't know enough about the processing of silica sand to know if it matters whether they have surface water or groundwater. I think the main issue is, do they have enough water? I think they can use surface water as well as groundwater, but somebody from the industry may know more about that than I do.
Okay. Question? Witness?
Not, excuse me. No.
Okay. Any other questions of the DNR? All right. Does the committee have any questions? Senator Scalzi, one more?
Well, I think we've got somebody coming up that's going to answer the river water versus groundwater question.
Okay.
Maybe.
The specific question is why you wouldn't use river water.
Say your name again.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Matt Bryan, Bryan Rock Products. There's really no right or wrong answer to that. In our case, we are along the river, and all the groundwater runs gradient through our site into the river. So to a certain extent, whether you take it from the groundwater at the site or from the river, it's really really about the same. I'm not a hydrogeologist by any terms, but that's one of the things on our site is we're stationed along the Minnesota River, and all the water is running through our site into the river directly.
Senator Westrum, did you have your hand up?
Mr. Chair, for the author, but if there's more for this witness,
I have one for the witness.
You have one for the witness, Senator Dietz.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you currently are doing not silica sand work, but the other stuff.
Correct.
Okay, so would he be considered a new permit then? And during this moratorium, would he be? So you're not technically doing silica sand work right now, but you're in the process. You got the EIS. You're doing some other stuff. Under this moratorium, would he be still considered a new, and would they still be able to work towards what they're, doing continuing their EIS and all of that stuff, or how does that impact him?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietz, it's a good question. And as the language is currently written in the bill, pursuant to the statewide moratorium, if they're not permitted as of March 1st, 2013, they would not be able to move forward until the expiration of that permit. They could continue to study it, but the moratorium would be in place. So it very well may not affect them if they're studying it, but nonetheless, they would be affected.
So they could continue doing their EIS or whatever you're doing to move forward to get there.
I'm not specifically learned on how moratoriums exactly work, but we would not be allowed to continue working with the agencies and working towards a permit, as far as I know, for a moratorium. And Senator Schmidt can maybe speak to that more eloquently than I can as to what we would or would not be able to do.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzick, I think the idea here is they would not be able to begin mining, and that's what we're trying to statewide moratorium would prevent.
But they could continue to work toward whatever, their EIS and their permit, that stuff.
Yes, that would be the intention of the language.
That might be the intention, but we feel that possibly the local units of government would not want to continue working with us while the state's under moratorium or doing a study of their own. And that's quite damaging to us, considering we're already doing a site-specific study of that kind and working towards a permit and under a moratorium at that time. So that's one of the concerns with the bill that we have, is that we're doing a site-specific EIS. We're under a moratorium while we're doing it, and we wouldn't be allowed to continue working towards a permit while a non-site-specific study was being done.
Okay. Senator Westrum, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, a couple questions and then few comments. Just Senator Schmidt, in your bill, we would actually give the EQB board the right to reject a local unit of government's decision. Can you explain how is that working? Is that's basically saying if the local county or a local unit of government grants permission, the EQB board can reject that? Is that
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, and that is correct. What we're doing here is we're asking the EQB, using emergency rulemaking authority this summer, to provide further clarification on categorical thresholds for EAWs and EISs. So what triggers those, and then also to provide further clarity on what is meant by phased and connected activity. And given the standards that result from that, we would also give the EQB the power to enforce those standards. In other words, not just to send a strongly worded letter to a local decision maker, but to say, you know what, this is the standard that was created. We expect you to follow that standard. If you are not following that standard, then there would be some teeth behind behind the EQB's power.
So Senator Schmidt, you would advocate taking away local control and giving it over to the state.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, what we're doing here on this particular issue as it pertains to silica sand mining is giving the Environmental Quality Board the authority this summer to establish further clarity on those standards and to enforce those standards. So as it pertains to, the triggers for an EAW or for an EIS or what constitutes phased and connected activity, the EQB would have the authority to enforce its standards.
Just so you understand, my understanding is correct, and it sounds like yours is. I mean, that's what we're doing. We're taking away the local decision-making and giving it to the state.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, a lot of our local units of government have asked for that sort of clarity and that sort of definition. What we've seen is the back and forth where folks are looking at each other, not knowing, what proper decisions should be made or who should be the final decision maker, so to speak. And what we're trying to set up here in Senate File 786 is a path forward for clarity.
So on that point, though, if there was one county that did want to move forward or one city or township, they couldn't under this provision, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, no, they certainly could move forward. But what we're trying to do here is determine what is the acreage that triggers an EAW? What's the appropriate acreage that triggers an EIS? What is meant by phased and connected? Have some certainty as to what we mean by those. What are the thresholds? And then once that's established, that's how you proceed. I mean, and make it very clear. And that's what we're looking for is to clarify those matters. So as long as you follow the standards that resulted from that process, you could proceed.
But we would halt the process during the moratorium until that was defined, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, under the proposed moratorium, that would be the idea. We're studying this. We're trying to add some more clarity to these processes. That's why we're hitting the pause button.
Okay. Phased and connect. Mr. Chair, you were around then. I'm not sure if there was anybody else around, maybe Senator Scoy, but if anybody was around about 15 years ago, phased and connect was a very hot button in the livestock for our farmers out in rural Minnesota. And the PCA at that time took it upon themselves to phase and connect anybody that was a partner or an owner in another farming operation that was going to own part of a feeder pig or a sow operation. And so it really made a lot of unintended consequences for our livestock farmers across the state, and that moratorium was pushed. And so I hear those words, and I'd caution you that we don't go down the road of unintended consequences. For a couple of years, the livestock, the farmers were in tumultuous times of trying to improve or add or expand their operations, and heavy government regulation came in and stopped some of them, paused a lot of them, and ultimately cost some from going ahead because of timing being important in that industry. And so I would just say let's proceed with caution when we start talking about phased and connected, because it's kind of an abstract concept, and I'd be a little worried about giving that too much authority to a state agency because of what I've seen them, what they tried to do in the livestock industry about 15 years ago. So just proceed with caution on that, because there can be unintended consequences, and it can mean jobs that are not created or not ever found or that don't occur because of it.
Senator Weber, did I miss you?
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Schmidt, I had a question regarding the technical assistance team. In the language and on page 3.3, line 22, it says a majority of the members must be from a state agency and have expertise in one or more of the following areas, and it lists a number of areas, which are all logical and what have you. Why wouldn't, if they're a technical assistance team, why wouldn't everyone need to have expertise in that area? I mean, you could wind up with someone that qualifies under a one of the suggested or the entities there that is nothing more than an advocate on one side or the other. And I don't know that a technical assistance team necessarily needs to have advocates. They need to have people that are knowledgeable in the field.
Mr. Chair and Sarah Weber, thank you for the question. I have to tell you, we're not expecting any advocates on this technical advisory team. These are professional state agency experts, and we want them to bring their expertise to bear on this process. So the reason we've enumerated or listed these different areas is because nobody can be an expert in everything. And I think you may be good on the hydrology, but you might not be so skilled in the air quality. And that's what we're trying to do there is get the right mix of expertise, not advocacy, expertise.
Mr. Chair, and I understand that, but it seems to me that what you're saying is that, but a majority having one or more. To me, it sounds like there's room for having people there that don't have expertise in any of them. That's what I was concerned about.
I see. Mr. Chair and Sir Weber, I think we're probably getting caught up on semantics here. I think the majority of the members must be from a state agency, and they must have expertise in one or more of the following areas. Okay. So I think that's what we're trying to get at there. We're looking for experts. But thank you. That's a good question.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, I was going to – it just seems like a grammatical thing. Maybe you can say, and all must have expertise in one or more. Make a little adjustment at some point.
Why do they have to be from state agencies? Can't they just be experts?
Mr. Chair, I suppose they could, but I got to tell you, of all the money that our local units of government has spent on consultants on this, and, you know, being a consultant myself, not in this area, I'll tell you what. We don't need to spend any more money on consultants. I think what we got to do is we got to tap our current, you know, expertise in state agencies. That's why we have them. That's why we pay them. Let's put them to work here.
You don't have to pay them to be on this advisory committee. You can just see if they're experts. Senator Rood.
It's not a good business model, Mr. Chair.
You know what's going to happen, don't you? The PCA and the DNR and all the rest of these agencies going to say, well, we got somebody on this board, so you're going to have to pay us extra money in order for us to run this board. I mean, that's what's kind of what the fiscal note is saying.
Chair, the attorneys do need to get paid.
Senator Root.
Mr. Chair and Senator Smith, in your conversation with Senator Westrum, you talked about the EQB, and I'm just wondering, do we establish a precedent by giving the EQB a control in this process that may affect other mining permitting in the state? Because that's a real concern to me, because I have, you know, several mining operations in my neck of the woods, and I don't know. Do we establish a precedent by giving EQB control? I mean, that's a scary thing for me.
Senator Westrum just said something about lawyers, that anybody could make a connection with just about anything we do here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Root, you know, I appreciate the question. We are really trying to focus in on silica sand mining. And the reason we're doing that is just because what we've seen in western Wisconsin over the last couple of years is a rapid increase in activity of permit requests. And I think this is a special case here. And we've taken great strides to really focus in on silica sand mining.
Senator Root.
And I just have one more question. We were talking about how this bill is tracking in the House and what's in and what's out. And I have this pesky thing called an iPad, and I find a companion bill for the Senate file 1018, but I don't find any companion for 786. Could you just maybe clarify that for me?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Root, that's correct. I got to tell you, I think there's a lot of provisions in here in Senate File 786 that could get the job done. And I wanted to identify those ideas and put them through the committee process. And, you know, I'm proud of the work we've done and of the conversations we've had. And, you know, we're sitting right here, you know, trying to put together an omnibus bill. And I hope that we're able to identify some provisions in here that make a lot of sense. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm glad that we got the conversation started in the House. And I'm glad that, the companion to Senate File 1018 has made it through the process. And we have some language in their omnibus bill right now. And I think these are going to match up just fine if that's the route we take going forward. So I understand the point you're making here. But I think at this stage in the game, the most important thing is that we've had the discussions in committee, and that we're poised to get some good language in our respective omnibus bills.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some real good questions here. And maybe council can help here with the word must versus the word may in some of the, and Senator, maybe you can as well. Must is a kind of a mandate word when you say that, like on section 4, page, or 3.29, when the local units of government must consider. Could that be softened at all, or is it going to be a requirement? Is it going to be a mandate from this committee that local units of government must abide by the findings of this committee or this council?
You know, Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbertson, you know, I understand you're pointing out the word must in 3.9, and this is Senate File 1018 for folks. But the overriding theme here of Subdivision 4 and of really of this bill is May. And that the local units of government do not have to act. All we're saying is please, you know, consider the findings. And if you don't want to abide by them, that's okay. What we do go on to say here, beginning on 3.31, is if the local unit of government does not agree with the technical assistance team's findings and recommendations, the detailed reasons for the disagreement must be part of the local unit of government's record of decision. So what we're saying, I think this creates some accountability and transparency for maybe some concerned citizens in local areas. If a local unit of government does not want to abide by the standards that the technical advisory team has established, just state why you're not doing so. And that's all we're asking here.
And just a quick follow-up. And I do see the word may used in 2.12 there. So just pointing that out to the chair. Also, the questions I have, I guess this is the Finance Committee. In Section 4, the Appropriations Technical Assistance, what are the blanks going to be filled in with as far as finances? Do we have an idea tonight or not?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbertson, we don't at this stage. I mean, we are, planning to lay this over. So I think we're looking to get some more clarity on that, but we don't have those numbers right now.
Okay. You would comment on something?
Mr. Chair, I just thought I could help with the question Senator Engelbertson had on the must and the local government language. If you look previous to that in that section, it says it ties it to if at the local government requests the assistance. So if you ask for the assistance, then you must consider it in your decision. You can't make the state spend money giving you assistance and then pretend they never gave it to you. That's what the must is for in there, is just if you're going to make the state do work for you, then you better at least address it in your findings.
Senator Osbeck?
Just to that point, local units of government, when they're actually finishing a resolution, whether they're approving something or denying something, have to provide findings of fact in order to base their answer to the question on. So that's not anything unusual, and actually that's the one thing I support out of the bill, is that they can do findings of fact as they do everything else.
Senator Ingridson.
Thank you. And when you're up there, I'm sorry, when you're up there with the local units of government, I asked the question earlier of staff. They couldn't answer it with the cost on the fiscal note. Do you have any idea what this is going to cost the counties for this committee? Senator, maybe you can answer. Any rough ballpark what it's going to cost to put this together?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbertson, I believe you're asking a question of this board we're proposing.
Right. Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the idea here is just to really have the conversation and to tee up the interaction between local decision makers and this technical advisory team. You know, I don't want this to be an incentive to hire new consultants. I don't want this to be a great expense. I envision this costing the local units of government, you know, a very small amount of money, if anything at all. And I think you're talking about, you know, maybe transportation costs to a meeting periodically or something like that. That's what I envision. I think not all counties are going to choose to participate either, or cities for that matter.
Senator Ingridson.
And just one more here. I don't want to be a pest, but the last page, Section 2 of the Technical Assistance Ordinance and Permit Library that you have in here. Some questions in business sensitive information. Would there be any of that information in this library that a business might be paying for? That, quite frankly, it's really not, you know, fair business practices if that information comes out. If the permit is a permit, is one thing, but if there's a business name attached to it, is that an issue at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbertson, good question. This is a library of public information, and this information, you know, in theory, is available from local units of government anyhow. And what this is basically sharing ordinances that have been adopted and put in place elsewhere. So for local decision makers or local units of government, they have a resource to go to that's formal and hopefully easy for them, a one-stop shop, so to speak. So I would not envision there being sensitive information.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Okay. Seeing none. Members, I'm going to try and give you some of my intent here because Senator Rudin makes a really good point about there not being a companion to one of the Senate files here. And I happen to have an omnibus bill that doesn't want to get taken down by one bill. And so what I put in the bill, I want it to be generally acceptable to most everybody. And maybe if we do have a final hearing on this at another time and people change their minds or they want to change the silica sand model here, that can all be changed outside of the omnibus bill. So my intent is to have some kind of a placeholder in the omnibus bill so that we have a silica sand standard somewhere along the way, because I understand the people who are concerned about something new happening in their area and not exactly knowing what the ramifications might be and trying to weigh what's good and what's bad and what might eventually come. So I'm sensitive to the issue. I also come from an area of the state where I think we overreact famously for environmental concerns. And when you've been doing something for 125 years and it takes you 4 years and $30 million to get a permit, you start wondering what's really going on around here. So I want to make sure one thing happens for sure here, and that is that whatever we do in southeastern Minnesota doesn't impact the rest of the state. And I understand that what Senator Schmidt is trying to do is to try to make sure that his area of the state is happy with what's going on. So there's a real lot of people who are concerned that a moratorium stops mining everywhere in the state. I mean, who knows what kind of mining that is. And so I will try and get some kind of a placeholder in the bill, something that the committee can live with as we try and move the omnibus bill out. And as we go further through the legislative session, Senator Schmidt, I think it's something that you can work on, maybe independent of the omnibus bill, but at the same time, trying to get something through. So if that's comfortable for the committee, I can adjourn now unless somebody else wants to make some comments on my comments.
If I could, Mr. Chair, just thank the committee and thank you for your time tonight. I know some of you have heard this issue before you a number of times, and I just appreciate your questions.
Okay. Thank you all for staying tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you all for coming out. Meeting adjourned.
Mr. Chair.